Greetings, my loves. Our third child, my first daughter, has come earthside, which means that I've got some things to tend to in the house away from the podcast studio. As much as I would love to play for you the new song that I wrote with Johnny Pemberton about a nitrous oxide dealer and something naughty he was doing to his butthole, I don't have time to do that. But the next episode, we will share this debut release. In the meantime, to sort of fill the space in you that needs new music, why not check out today's guest's new album, Zone Black, which you can find on Drag City. I hope you'll check it out. You can go to dragcity.com, Zone Black. It's an amazing album, as are all of his albums. Did I already say he's one of my best friends? I'm sorry, y'all. I'm scrambled. I don't know if you heard this or not, but for a man, having a baby is pretty intense. You know, for a woman, it's easy. You know, it just kind of comes out. They're happy. They sing throughout the labor. But for a man, it's really tough on us. And it's heavy, man. We get there's no words for it, honestly. We get gas. You know, I have like a kind of mild case of gas and lots of other stuff. Like my arms feel kind of like more sweaty than usual. So there's stuff I'm going through, which means I can't do the spectacular, complex, beautiful, world-changing, transformative intro that I would like to do that my guest deserves. But if you could do me the honor of checking out his new album, I will send you great astral blasts of solar jizz right into your pineal gland tonight, or the night after you check out his album. All right, we're jumping right into this. You probably know Emil Amos from the Holy Sons, maybe the Grails, maybe Om, or any of the other amazing ways that he manifests his artistry into the world. He's one of my dear friends. I'm so lucky that I met him in college. Definitely would not be a comedian or a podcaster if I hadn't gotten to hang out with this maniac, super genius musical auteur. And I love him so much. God, I'm tired. I'm sorry. I must sound crazy. Everybody, welcome back to the DTFH, Emil Amos. Emil, welcome back to the show. You know, you're my top requested guest.
How do you get that stat?
Varying, social media threads where people will be like, I love Emil episodes. When's Emil coming back? We got to get Emil back. And I get it. I love the conversations we have, man. It's like always so fun. I love the last one in Chapel Hill. That was so, when we were doing Nitrous.
Yeah, I mean, there's some obvious aspects of why it works. Like, it's so funny I'm saying this, I've never sold anything through this podcast. So there's like no pressure to be like, I loved your book or anything. There's just right. Two people with like, you know, philosophy in front of them. You don't have to be a host with me, right?
Right.
Like, you don't have to host a show. So we get to just hang out. And it's a little bit more like, I guess if you have to use the word, it's more like co-hosting. But you don't have to baby me. You don't have to be like, I really loved your book. Blah, blah, blah. So we because that's an intrinsic.
I did love your book.
Well, yeah, I didn't write it yet. But
oh, come on. You can share the book with people. It's erotic. It's incredible. Everyone loves Princess Diana.
Yeah, it's my life's work.
I think it's controversial, but yeah, I love it. I don't, her appetites in that book don't reflect my understanding of her, but I, you know, artistic license is everything.
Do you remember the time I was about 1990 7, and I was at the Funhouse machine, the pinball machine in the basement of the cafeteria, and it was a nice sunny day, and I was winning, and you walked up and you're like, "Did you hear about Nietzsche?" And I was like,
"Oh, no."
I was like, "No, I didn't." You were like, "It came out today. They dug up his corpse and he was a hermaphrodite."
And I did not say that.
And I was like, "Wow, that explains so much, you know." And you're like,
"They dug up his corpse." Idiot.
You would do that to me every two, three days, and I would never stop believing you. I think because I wanted to believe you were taking me somewhere I'd never been, you know.
All right, guys, it's time. We finally got the permissions. We're going to go dig up Nietzsche's grave and see what kind of dick he had. Holy shit! This is going to make history!
I feel like you don't remember 99% of the punchlines from the prank calls either, but people still walk up to me all the time and they're like, "You're thinking of a bunny rabbit. You're thinking of a rabbit." And you're like, and I say that to you and you go, "What's that from?" And I go, I remember that.
No, I remember you thinking of a bunny rabbit now. I remember calling that clairvoyant. That was the best. We had so much fun with this.
I know. No.
That was such an exciting moment. Like a little mini, like, discovery of fire. When we realized we could safely prank call people in like rural North Carolina without getting caught because of that amazing, like the fact that you had to call, that you couldn't trace the number at all. The angry cops, the off-duty cops at Jack in the Woods, you know, who we're fucking with, and they're like, they want to arrest us and beat us so bad, but they can't get us.
I think that was actually Club Universe, but you said you had a woman in the basement of Jack in the Woods.
I've got a bitch in the basement. You got a what?
We've never put that one out.
You got a what in the basement? A what? The cop. It's so not cool. This is a poor off-duty cop just trying to make a little bit of extra money. And for those of you who, we made a series of prank calls in college. That we both are to this day quite proud of. And it was so fun to do because the college we were at had a switchboard. So there was no way to penetrate into the room. You didn't know what room it was coming from. And our friends worked security. So they, because the students had to run the college. So they, it didn't matter if they knew that we were making prank calls. They weren't, I don't think they were ever like going to bust us. I don't think we ever got told not to do it. Did we?
No, never. No, full carte blanche.
That's how you understand the deep state.
That was the first, true audience you had because we would all gather around you and kind of watch you go to work, and it was so effortless for you. It wasn't like a stand-up set where you inevitably are going to be self-conscious and prepare, because there was no preparation. You just had to be yourself, just funny in real time, and you always hit the bullseye, and everybody would just watch this chemical reaction and just kind of be amazed, because none of us could not laugh, you know. None of us could pull it off, and you would like invent full three-dimensional characters on the spot. I mean, one of the great ones is the storytelling. You know, I mean, people who have heard the episode, it's called Insidious Mind Control on Drifter Sympathy.
No way. You
can go look it up. It's about an hour long of Duncan just being genius, and like,
we'll put him out one day.
Yeah, that's true. Right. We will. And we'll put out the bonus stuff. People always ask me, there's got to be more in there. And there is more, like the bitch in the basement. I mean, clearly at the time, whenever I put those out a few years ago, I thought that maybe people weren't ready for the bitch in the basement. But they're probably ready now, you know.
They're not ready for that. No one's ready.
You've done Everyone the focus will be group mad. Work.
Everyone will be mad. There's so many people will be like, "Are you... you fucking sociopath. I think you're kind of downplaying your role in this, and I appreciate it because it makes me sound a little funnier than I was, but you were like this, like Mephistopheles in my ear, like, because you would drive it darker. Like, I would probably be doing something offensive and dark, but then you would whisper some completely horrible direction for it to go in my ear, and then we would, like, then it would just drop down lower and darker, and it was such a perfect, and I'd be afraid. Sometimes some of your suggestions, I would be afraid to do it. Like, I was like, God, Jesus, that's fucked up. And then we do it, and it was always so funny, and just, I needed that, man. I needed that nudge into the shadows. I was already there, but I needed that. Let's go into a sub-basement and see what happens.
I mean, I think that was the first evidence of, like, what could have been our writing synergy, which we never followed to fruition, because we went to LA, right, and then you were sort of working on pilots, and you were sort of looking into the idea of being a writer, and then I left, and we still, to this day, we've never actually collaborated on something besides this record that we still haven't put out, which we will put out. And the calls are kind of like the evidence of, like, a certain kind of synergy that just got left in the 90s, you know?
Yeah, man. But, you know, that, I think it's so funny to, like, see, like, all of the little, I don't know, foreshocks of, you know what I mean? What we were going to turn into. Cause, like, then I never thought, oh, I'll be a comedian one day. I never thought that, or never, with podcasting didn't even exist. It's just so interesting. Or trolling, you know, I don't even think the term trolling existed at that time. Did it? Like in the sense of, like, what it is now. And you know, I really think people, based on what we did, people underestimate how many college kids have discovered some terroristic methodology for infiltrating, like, groups and just causing chaos just because they're laughing in their dorm rooms. Like, I so many things that pop up on the internet, or so many dramas, or so many things where people are, they think, oh, it must be real, because no one could be so rotten as to cause this level of chaos for fun. And I just think back to those nights.
Yeah, I think that's probably how the Declaration of Independence started, you know, just hanging out, laughing in the dorm room. And then you're like, what if we just do it, bro? I also think I was listening to a podcast of one of my label owners, and he was talking about the beginning of starting a label, and he was saying that, like, basically, like, when you make huge life decisions that are incredibly risky, you really need to do those when you're really young and you have no sort of foreknowledge of, like, what could go wrong. And right, there's so much about life that is ruled by that dynamic. Because as you get older, I feel like it's cliche that worry sort of sets in and starts to bottleneck your behavior. So you gotta, I mean, maybe you feel like you're still in the risk zone. And I, as an artist, I guess I am too. It's my job to stay in a kind of dreaming zone and not shut that down. But I think about that, like, how much worry is intelligent versus how much naivety. But I think that was a big part of that mind state that you can sentimentalize, is that just, like, we had nothing in front of us. We didn't know where we were going. And that's a beautiful state of mind, because it's a totally being in the moment thing, you know?
Yeah. Totally, man. And that is the absolute danger that presents itself to any adult. And I one of my recent guests wrote a whole book on aging. And one of the things he talked about was how Kotler is his name, Stephen Kotler, One of the things he talked about is how there are two parts of the, I guess, I'm sorry, Stephen Collar, I don't think you listen to my podcast, or anyone who's a fan, I'm going to ruin it. I'm not a genius like he is. But basically, like, there's two parts of the brain. And one of them is the sort of exploratory part of the brain. Going out in the world, finding your way, looking around, trying to gather resources, whatever it is. You're out there, you're exploring, you're like, this is the hunter-gatherer out hunting or whatever. And then there's another part of your brain, which is basically the defense part of your brain. So if your brain thinks you found all the shit you need, now it's like, we got to protect the shit that we got. That's where you enter into the danger zone that your friend talked about, which is the hunter-gatherer part of your brain. It begins to atrophy. And there's a lot of like bad things that happen that go along with that. Then a lot of people associate that with aging, when really what it is you've like gotten imbalanced. You've gone into a fully protected, you don't feel like you don't need to look anymore. Why would I look? There's risk. I don't need to go hunt more things. We have all the meat we need for the winter. I'm not going back out there. And then that's when a lot of cognitive decline can start happening. And his recommendation in this book, one of them is get outside and do like risky shit, you know, like in a safe way. And it opens that part of your brain up again. You know, the moment you push out, whatever it may be, man, the moment you push out, it doesn't have to be some starting a fucking label or going into deep credit card debt to make a movie. It could be like, I don't know, take boxing classes. You know what I mean? Do something that you're like, I'm too old for that. I would never do that. What the fuck is that? He's a skier. And so what he did is for the book to experiment with this idea is he went and tried to learn like 10 of the most dangerous free skiing tricks. And like, to see how the changes that happen. But yeah, man, this is the classic sad self-imprisonment that happens when and it seems to be tied up with some form of like self-perceived success.
Yeah, I guess
now you don't want to change.
That's I think as a 13-year-old, I switched from skateboarding to music, and I think that was a very wise decision, because in music you can't really harm yourself quite as immediately and as drastically. And I mean, I talk a lot about skateboarding, but to me it's like a really amazing metaphor, because I could probably sit back for 5 years and try to crack the code in music for my next record or something, and try to make something that really, really like, you know, blew somebody's mind somewhere. But for skateboarding, it's like you're coming up to 18 stairs. You're 16 years old, and you're like, no one, you actually know this in skateboarding. No one has ever done a hard flip down this particular legendary set of stairs. They know it. They have it all nerded out. They have it all statted out. And there's this really cool thing about skateboarding that I apply to music that sadly nobody else seems to, but it's called an ABD versus an NBD. And what it means is that's already been done and that's never been done. So what I've always wished is people would apply that to music. Because
that's so
then
cool.
You wouldn't just hear the same devices over and over and over again. But people in music don't.
That's such genius.
It's so cool, because in skateboarding, there's a very specific, I'm talking about a very specific 18 stair set in California, inevitably, that like everyone has charted out. Like, okay, he did a backside flip. He did the 360 flip. He did the. So even if you're not a skateboarder and you're listening, the idea is that it's like going to the moon. It's like it's been done or it's not been done. And human beings have never seen it done. So if you're a 16-year-old kid and you keep going up to the lip of the 18 stairs and you're just thinking, I know I can do this, then you're entering a field of decision-making and self-consciousness that's just so immense. I think this, I don't know if there's like a new book or a documentary, but a lot of people seem to be talking about this, like the level of depression that goes on with Olympic athletes. Is that like a thing right now?
I've never heard that. What is that?
I don't know. It's some new shit that was maybe on TV or something, but it makes so much sense, right? Because like you're talking about waking up your brain and sort of grabbing this opening field of potentiality for yourself for just like a healthy exercise daily. But they are measuring themselves up against the entire history of humanity and the future of humanity, right? So if you know the sprint has been done in 0.7 seconds or whatever the metric is, then you're measuring yourself in a moment knowingly against, you know, the rest of all time and all the rest of all human accomplishment. And that right. level of pressure is really relatively unnatural. It only happens to a few people. So I think that back to, you know, wanting to go there, I think often about this quote I feel like you always used to say, and I've been quoting it irresponsibly because I don't know what you were talking about, but some old thing you used to say about a particular Buddhist monk that would say, if you can refuse to come down this path of like analyzation, and if you can refuse to come down this path of spiritual ambition, then don't come down. Do you remember where that came from?
Yeah, I believe that's from Chogyam Trungpa, and I can't remember which. I think it's in the foreword to Cutting Through Spiritual Materialism. Could be wrong about that, where he says, don't do this. Don't. He says, because if you do it, the moment you start down the path, you can't stop going down the path. And the path, the funny thing about the start to go down the path, most people, when they get into meditation, they may not want to admit it to themselves, but they want in some way, shape, or form to get enlightened. They want some power. They want like Harry Potter level shit to happen to them. And they don't realize by the time they get to the end of that path, the person who went in the rabbit hole is not the person who comes out. And it's gone. In other words, you're gone. You're out. Like you, if you get enlightened, the part of you that was like, I want to get enlightened, is gone. Like it's just gone. It's like a dream or something. It's gone like the dream you had 5 years ago that you can't remember when you woke up and you were like, that was a fucking cool dream. Wow, I'll never forget that dream. It's like that level of just, you're gone. Extinguishment is what they call it. The candle, you're blown out. You blew yourself out. So that is the ethical instruction that you find in front of most grimoires and spiritual texts is like, maybe you need to really consider what you're getting into before you actually get into it.
Well, that makes total sense to me. And I think we should iron this point out a little bit more, because if not, it just sounds like we're sort of having fun rambling. But there's a big underlying point here. And you picture us back in the dorm room, and we're just having fun and we're laughing and we're completely in the moment. It's a beautiful thing, and we'll spend the rest of our lives trying to get back in that zone for sure. But once you start seeing it in the bigger scope of like your life's work, once you start like seeing that as the beginning of something, then you're measuring, you know, everything. You're starting to be scientific, right? And
yep.
When you start to look at your life, at your talent, what you think you can do with it, then you're going to inevitably start perceiving an arc. Because there's always this sense in society, there's always this sense of like, where is this person in their career? You're gonna feel that as you talk to your manager.
Yeah.
You're gonna feel that as you look at the billboard and see yourself next to Brad Pitt, you know, one time, when you're driving down the LA freeway, you're going to look up and you're going to go, that's probably the only time I'm ever going to be on a billboard with Brad Pitt. Every success is indicative of like the coming failure. You know that you know, that this is the peak. So yeah. As soon as you start to measure, the arc presents itself. The structure starts to present itself. So in a way,
yeah.
Trump is saying, if you cannot measure, if you can just exist, then just do that. Because once you start like taking samples, soil samples, and studying the world that you're in and your own landscape, that never ends, right?
Well, I think it's like kind of. I mean, I think it's like whenever I've gotten into anything like Buddhism or whatever, like there's a 50, 60, 70% part of me that's like, this is a LARP. Like, I'll do it. It's interesting. But there's a lot of me that's like, it can't be real. Like, it's not all the shit they're talking about can't be real. Like, extinguishment of identity or some, you know, luminous awakened quality that is accessible to every single human because it is what you actually are. And it's been obfuscated by some temporary fleeting personality or thing you call personality, which is really just a very easy mistake to make, which is like, oh, because I have a series of thoughts, therefore I must be something, you know, like that's a easy trap to fall into. And you hear like all this shit, but you hear it with your thinking mind, and your thinking mind is desperate to continue. It's like being in the forefront of your awareness. So it's tricky, and it says, oh, great. Yeah, get into this stuff because my God, this is going to really help us think better. Like, wait till the thoughts we're going to have are going to be really good after you get into this. And then because you've decided to, I mean, it's like, look, I don't care why you took the hit of acid. You took the hit of acid because you didn't believe acid worked. You took the hit of acid because you wanted to like talk to aliens. You took the hit of acid to cure your trauma. It doesn't matter. You took a very powerful hit of acid, and over time you are going to potentially cease to exist at some point during that trip. You're going to see the walls melt, a lot of cool shit. That's the beginning phase. Everyone who starts meditating, inevitably, even though this is something that gets underemphasized on purpose, get ready, because your shit'll happen to you that you thought couldn't happen. Then that stuff starts happening, like, oh, wow, it's this stuff and that stuff. And oh, my God, wow, just like they said, and just like all the people said when they went to the East, here it is. But but you're not stopping there. You won't stop at that point. Some people try, you can't. And then slowly over time, maybe lifetimes, but maybe a lifetime, suddenly you realize that's thinking too. That's just more thoughts. And then what I'm trying to get at here is like, the untamed thinking part of your mind becomes tamed. Your thoughts go from being this cavalcade of madness to an interrogation, a curiosity, a focused sort of curiosity that is beginning, because you catch a glimpse of emptiness or whatever you want to call it, what you really are. You know, you hear this shit up in the beginning, everything you see is your mind. And you think whatever you want to think about that. It makes no sense intellectually, it makes sense or whatever. But then you begin to realize what that actually is saying. And then the part of your mind that was untrained starts spending time examining that. What that means, what that is. That's, so it's like, there's lots of names for it. One of them is like Rigpa. You kind of like catch a glimpse, you're meditating one day, suddenly you're three hits of acid, annihilated, just meditating. You get so excited and instantly stops. Now you have a little sample that you start interrogating. Like, what the fuck was that? Was that real? Was that anything? Hopefully you have someone to talk to about it. And then that thing that blew your mind, it starts happening more and more. Now you're getting a familiarity with this space that you thought was from the acid or from a good meditation session. And then at some point, it's like that space apparently becomes more real to you than your thoughts were. You know what I mean? In other words, now your thoughts aren't even working anymore because you've come to understand that they are just as a series of like fireworks. It's a never ending cognitive fireworks show or something. And then, so now you get to the point where in the dream, where you realize you're dreaming. You know that part when you're having the nightmare and you realize you're dreaming?
Yeah.
Have you ever? That's what it is. And so then you might still be having the nightmare, but the edge of the nightmare has been dulled, because how the fuck is the nightmare going to scare you anymore when you know it's a dream? Except it's happening while you're fucking awake. It's happening while you're awake. That's the crazy part about it. It's like it's happening middle of the day. All the things that used to torment you have no more power in the sense that they have gone from being foreground to background.
Yeah, to clarify real quick, I think when I'm talking about the Olympics, obviously I'm talking about temporal ambitions. And then, you know, I'm assuming Trumpo was talking about the spiritual ambitions. But the metaphor works however right. you want to apply it. And
yep. Yeah, right.
I think I never mention what I'm working on or anything, but I just, is it 2 days ago, I put out my new solo record on Drag City called Zone Black. And it was sort of a space that I could like put all my ideas that, you know, weren't literal like Holy Sons or even Grails. Like it was a little bit more of like a dream space that where I would categorize kind of dream music or like sort of deprivation tank music, sort of just music that wow. that's a little bit more, I don't know, ephemeral or something. But so I was looking back over some interviews and I was doing a bunch of new ones and I was noticing something I had said about, you know, never stopping to see what's next. I had always driven by this like absolute total rabid hunger to keep finding new sort of horizons and reading yourself saying something like that. I was kind of like, what is this thing? Like, who is this person? What's exactly wrong with right. them? You know? And it's interesting that as the arc presents itself over your creative life or Olympics, you know, there's going to be a point at which you break the pole vaulting height, right? And then you're inevitably going to prepare emotionally to step down. You know, the Olympics are every 4 years. You're probably not going to be the best in 4 years, right?
Right.
So, but in my career, I don't ever really, there's just no arc is presenting itself. I just still am curious, you know? So I don't know what that is, why that is. It seems like you're supposed to slow down. I read this interview with Terry Riley once where he was talking about, you know, he's like, me and my wife, we've entered the late stage of our career where like our job is to catalog everything we've ever done. And we sit around, we label it, and we basically say, you know, this is 67 in that park where we did that one thing with Allen Ginsberg or whatever. And then, you know, it's just like, I was like, oh shit, that's going to be me someday. I'm entering the phase. I'm going to start cataloging. I'm going to start looking backwards. I'm going to start labeling because I have so much stuff that still hasn't come out. I don't really know if it'll ever be important to anyone else, but it's there on my hard drives. And I
know what you're talking about.
And it's like that phase just never quite begins because there's still more that I want to do. That I'm still in that dorm room that we were in. There's still more that I want to do that I'm still in that dorm room that we were in. I'm still,
yeah, man.
You know what I mean?
Dude, this is the instruction that I love. There's two instructions that come from this form of Buddhism that I just can't stop being interested in. One of them is, this is from Shogyam Trungpa, it's disown. Whatever the last meditation you had, disown that. So you don't get to hold on to your past meditation practice. It's very similar to stand-up, which is you're only as good as your last set. Like, and really, you have to disown that one too. So you disown whatever came before in your artistic life or your spiritual life. And that is incredibly frustrating for the people who want to keep talking about their fucking ayahuasca trip where they destroyed or devastated or they got the transmission or learned how to do the thing that whatever, and they talked to the gods. That's very frustrating because it's like, okay, well, that's not happening now. And then when you enter, so that's the first step, disown whatever happened before. And then the next step, it comes from the Lojong mind training slogans, which I'm sorry, you guys, I always say this one because it's like my mantra at this point. Abandon all hopes of fruition. Meaning when you go into the thing, don't have any, as much as you can, let go of whatever the fuck that thing is that is telling you artistically, this is going to be the next big thing. This is going to blow the minds. This is going to show people that I have an arc of where I'm getting better and better and better, or really show the audience in my head that. And so so these two things are designed to sort of essentially decapitate the materialistic, transactional, capitalist profit motive that can get into all forms of creativity. And it's a training. You have to do that. And then that's why a lot of people will say Buddhism's really boring, because that's fucking boring. Like, what, you know, you've taken away my hope, my joy. This will be when I get enlightened. This is my, wait until people see or hear this. And you've taken away the, I've made some great shit. I'm a great meditator. Boy, have I really gotten this shit down. Because it's no, it doesn't matter. Now you're just, you're starting over every time. Literally starting over. And then that, to me, that's a very paradoxically fruitful zone to find yourself in.
Yeah.
Because you can't really want to be fruitful, because now if you want to be fruitful, that's hopes of fruition. So in other words, the moment you start thinking, oh my God, this is a great way to create a very fruitful zone for my creation to get the power that comes or the rush that comes, it's like, nope, now you're not doing the thing. So that's where it gets really, that's where it's threading the needle, I guess you could say.
Well, I think when you look at the face of Stanley Kubrick or something, you don't see someone who thinks they're fabulous. You know, you see someone who's under a great internal strain. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So
it's a little sick.
Yeah, exactly, definitely sick. But there's no sense of some, glamorous stride on the red carpet. You never see him in that circumstance, no. Right? He's never and I've done this and I've done that and I've done this. It's it's always, there's something about Eyes Wide Shut where I don't know much about the technical stuff, but that it's notoriously it was his most difficult movie and it went on forever and it was a lot of problems. That seems more indicative of his day-to-day reality, is that he's,
yeah.
You know, if there's anything good about what he did in the past, it's a massive hurdle because he's going to be compared to it. So he's constantly haunted by everything that went right. Do you know what I mean? So there's there's a payback on the capitalist end of things. Like the more you accomplish, the more the billboard with Brad Pitt starts to fade, right? The more good things happen, the more Korn gets that number one song. It's that's as good as you're going to get. That's really how capitalism works, is every victory is that's as good as you're going to get, bro. Like, be happy with that because it's over starting now. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, right, dude. You're getting like, it's basically like, this is so easy to do. And every day, it's not like you just decide not to do it. Every day you have to keep yourself from falling prey to like who's giving you your paychecks. Like you have to really like understand that like you're getting all forms of paychecks. You're not just getting like money from stuff you do. You're getting the paycheck of the person you respect giving you some that was really good. Or you're getting the paycheck from any externalized paycheck system is going to like cause some like dilution of whatever it is you're up to. You know, that this is the Jesus in the desert, which is, I think, the ultimate analogy for what we're talking about here, is that nobody wants to be in the fucking desert. When you go in the desert, you're instantaneously going to be tempted to take shortcuts to get the fuck out of the desert. You get the, you know, you're hungry. So what does the Lord of Darkness say? Why don't you turn these stones into bread and you can eat? there you go. Anytime you find yourself in your head trying to turn the stones into bread, you're fucked. You're fucked. So what is the response? Man cannot live by bread alone. Blast you, Jesus. I don't know. He didn't say it, but you got me on that one, Jesus. Two nerds in the desert, if you really think about it. Trust fund kid and like the bully. It's basically like the fucking Breakfast Club. But with that, like, you know, miscreant that we all wanted to model ourselves after, like trying to torture the default reality children. But anyway, my point is, you realize that, I mean, you want to get depressed. The reason you're going to get depressed is because you're getting, at least my theory on that would be, you're getting fed by something, by an institution or a person or a set of metrics. You've become dependent on that as the thing that makes you real. And once you get to the point where you can't get fed by that anymore, no matter how much you want, because your body's breaking down, you're not going to fucking pole vault again. Then you have to sit with your actual suffering that you were distracting yourself from with those crumbs that you were being fed by the devil.
Yeah, I think, I mean, Trump is sort of saying, like, if you can remain in your own personal biosphere and not judge yourself by any metrics, and you can just wander the world and enjoy the flowers and enjoy, you know, your daily, your coffee in the morning. If you can stick to those simple things, then do that. But, you know, I look back at being, say, like 9 years old and just thinking about the artistic opportunities that Paul McCartney was sort of rising to the challenge of in front of the whole world. When I was like nine, I was just like, for better or worse, I saw myself in it. I was like, I can do that. I want to do that, you know? And on that day,
yeah,
a metric was set. Do you know what I mean? An impossible metric.
That is a tough metric.
There's never going to be another Paul McCartney. It's just not going to happen. I mean, they try with Michael Jordan all the time. They're like trying to always measure stats against Michael Jordan. But as a phenomena, there will never be another Michael Jordan in terms of time and the way the world experienced him. There will be people Olympically that can probably do just about the same thing, but they won't serve the same purpose in the history of the world. And same with Paul McCartney. I mean, there's just nobody's going to ever play that exact role. So I look back at those little sort of oracle points, like the Never Ending Story, you know, like these points at which I was like gonna pass the precipice or something, and that particular one was like a defining thing to decide without knowing you're deciding that you will be that character. I'm that character in the narrative, you know, which can haunt you, can be a bad thing. And then I think back to moving to Portland when I moved out of your apartment, which I still kind of feel a little bad about because I really did leave you in the the lurch. I mean, obviously, things.
I never thought. Did I think that?
I think when someone breaks a lease and like leaves you in an apartment alone, I think it's just inevitable that you feel kind of abandoned. I don't think it.
Did I tell you I feel abandoned? I don't remember.
I don't think we talked about it. We sort of just decided not, which was weirdly mature of us at such an immature period. But I think we just didn't want to get into it. But I think it probably did fuck you up a little bit.
Was I a little butthurt? I don't remember. I was probably a little butthurt, but I don't remember being butthurt. Like, usually I remember being butthurt. Like, and I don't remember being, like, too butthurt, but I probably was. I mean, I'm definitely, like, crabby and shitty. Like, one level of me is very neurotic and crabby and shitty. So it's a highly probable that I was like, he abandoned his lease.
We didn't really go into it, but if you look back at our lives, that was another huge moment, because the second I got in my truck and drove off up that highway towards Portland, Oregon, and you locked the door to your now single apartment, that the rest of our lives sort of started at that moment. You know, you had to sink or swim, and I had to do the same. And then weirdly, our lives kind of, they were very parallel. Like every failure and every weird little victory seemed to mirror each other in a strange way. But it was so ruthlessly hard. I think because we're not like really, the world isn't really drawn to us. You know, I mean, we've said it a billion times. We just have an underdog thing. And so, but if I hadn't left, who knows what would have happened. But I feel like things got better because I did, or something for both of us.
For sure they did. Yeah. You had to do that. I mean, I can only remember in retrospect, but you always seem kind of like a wandering wizard to me anyway. Like, you know what I mean? Like you seem like kind of a traveler. So I think on some level it made sense to me. And also, like, you're a musician, you know what I mean? Working at a comedy club, like, you know, like that doesn't make sense. We were, I think, hanging out and enjoying that weirdness of being in LA and just being like, what the fuck is this? But I think it was kind of destined that you weren't going to stay at that two bedroom apartment in West Hollywood, walking distance from the Comedy Store. Ridiculously cheap in those days, by the way. I can't even imagine how much that fucking apartment
was. $900, I think.
This is nothing. This is like a wonderful place, like right in the middle of town. I didn't know where we were or how good we had it either.
That was
like, that's the other funny thing.
So much money to me at the time. So much money. $900 a fucking month. That was, whew.
It was a lot based on what we were getting paid at the store. That's for
we
sure.
We weren't paid it enough like to do it. That was actually what broke my back. I actually did the math one day. I was like, oh, I got to leave. But then this is the exact point at which I'm always stuck at in my podcast that I have to go back to. But this is when the real story, I think, begins. Even though everything before that point was like the building, the molding of who we are at this moment. The point where you have to sink or swim, where you actually have to like go on stage, is just such a major test that I just dreaded so much. I really did not want to do that at all.
Yeah.
And one, man, it's a bummer that I can't think of the term, but a friend of mine that knows our guru buddy in Boston, a friend of mine, I was talking to him once. This was a major moment for me. I was talking to him once online about my guru, and I was talking about how one issue that me and my guru had, and you may have some sort of parallel Buddhist concept for this, but one thing that really hung us up, and him, it hung him up totally, and it hung me up in a very awkward manner that I had to figure out how to get over, at least to some degree. And there's a word, and it's just sad that I'm not going to be able to present it to you right now, but it's a word for a psychological complex, a psychological phenomenon when you get on stage and you show people something, you then become observed. You become the observed.
Yeah.
And so then the internal chemical nature of what you are doing, it's very society of the spectacle, I guess, but the internal nature, molecular nature, completely changes because it is now not the thing. For example, when like a pretty girl takes an Instagram video of themselves meditating, they're probably not meditating.
Yeah.
They're probably not.
I love spiritual shots are my favorite. Everyone has to do. I feel so bad for the spiritual teachers who have to put their fucking picture a book. They don't want to. They don't want to put their picture on a book. They have to. The publisher's like, no, you got to put, and what are you going to put on there? Right? You can't put a picture of you, like, you know, awkwardly, like, walking out of the bathroom after you just took a shit. Like, you can't put a picture of,
you could.
Know what I mean? Like, a weird.
You could,
but you got to, like, you got to sell. Look, man, we live in the marketplace. You got to sell some books, and nobody's going to. This book looks interesting. Yeah, the art of true awareness. And on the back, it's just you, like, taking an uncomfortable shit.
What?
No, you got to get a photographer who's taken. Oh, they've taken pictures of some of the great spiritual teachers. They are like, they know how to get the right lighting to make you seem particularly enlightened. Yeah, right. I know what you're saying, man. It's like, that's a very fascinating flower growing off of the satanic bush that we're talking about.
Well, I think my
you start acting.
I don't know if exactly. Acting is what it is, and musicians are kind of actors, and I was like, no, that's not what I am.
You start acting like yourself.
Yeah, right. And so my guru was like, we never talked about it like that. And for anybody out there, you can actually find that the phrase for that, for how the molecular situation is changed by observation. It's totally such a great concept. But my guru,
you're talking about the double slit experiment.
Is that what it is?
Observation effect. Yeah, that if you take photons, try to put them through a slit. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
You try to put them through a slit. Apparently, if they're being observed, it changes the way that they behave versus if they're not being observed, which is a very curious effect that lots of people apparently are confused by, but it's true. Like, you observe these little guys trying to, like, if you observe them, they will become particles. If you don't observe them, they'll become a wave.
Yeah, my guru, you know, he was like kind of a street character that didn't go to college or anything. So he wasn't like name checking, like, you know, Wittgenstein, but he knew extremely advanced concepts just by instinct. And he could like just kind of rattle them off the top of his head if it was an appropriate moment to teach me something. And so when he, I think, glimpsed that process, which was sort of the star maker machinery in the underground at that time, which was pretty fucking serious. I mean, we were right there when the Nirvana thing was happening, and people like Beck were just getting pulled out of, you know, the underground. It could have been anyone. It really felt like it could have just been anyone that got pulled into the castle. You know, and so I was like, still in my mind, there was a part of me that was still 8 or 9 years old with the Paul McCartney thing. And I was like, I could see the problem. I could see the problem with going on stage. I could see that it was going to pervert everything, because as the pole vaulter, your job is to, on one side of your brain, know exactly the height that your competitor did 4 years ago in the Olympics. And so there's an analytical part that is very aware of the measuring sticks. And then there's the other part of yourself that's obligated to bring that wild space where there's chaos and just no measurement, and you're supposed to, you're obligated to bring this thing, this gift you have on you know, yeah. Star Search or whatever. And
yeah.
that relationship of holding both of those things at the same time is extremely difficult for a young person to figure out, right?
Yeah.
So that was where, when I left your apartment and we both had to just fucking hit the pavement, that was where we were like, you know, we had to develop formulas, tricks, ways to like get our brain into a space where we could find out how to tread water, you know? And that was probably the most important transition in a lot of ways, because if I hadn't made it through that transition, I would be whatever, dead or down at the Circle K right now, washing a car, just fucking wanting to die, you know, like living a sort of yeah. suicidal reality, because I never really made it through the transition I needed to go through. And so that period of our lives, I constantly return to and analyze, because that's where we were again, still in the dorm room, but presented with a whole new mathematical reality, which was like, how the fuck are we going to thread this needle? And I know,
yeah,
I right. know you were scared and confused and extremely, probably just sure it wasn't going to work. Man.
Yeah. I mean, I think I was a bit of a, you know, there's some quality of nihilism that I would lean into as a method or something, like, you know, like just a general sense of like defeat. You know, like if I'll just lean into defeat, and I know that's like not a popular bit of advice, but it was sort of like, look, I mean, this doesn't work out for anybody, number one. Like, who doesn't really, like, statistically, it's an incredible anomaly if you manage to support yourself with any form of artistic anything. So therefore, the pursuit of the thing is a nihilistic pursuit, in that they're more than likely, you're just going to like crash and burn like everybody else who tried it and end up at the Circle K, you know what I mean? Or wherever, mm-hmm. end up like, you know, back home living with your mom, or, you know, packing boxes in a book distribution place, which was like something my mom weirdly held over my head when she was advising me to not pursue this bullshit. It's like, I'm friends with Gary over at Zammy Books, and you can pack books. Oh, this is such a look. If you want your kid to like keep trying to become a comedian, tell him his other option is packing books.
Well, it's kind of like the perfect thing, because it's like she's maybe knowingly telling you, like, you want to be the person who writes the book, but you're not that guy. You're the guy that packs the
yeah.
book, you know.
You're going to pack the motherfucking books. If someone's got to pack them, someone's got to write them. You're going to pack them, honey.
And the mothers give you that weird contradictory message with their eyes, too, where they're kind of like, it's great. You're great at packing books. That's what life is packing books. But there's that little glint of condescension where they're like,
sure. Yeah. I get it. You know, that's the glory of becoming a parent. If you want to forgive your parents, one great way to do it is become a parent and experience the burning desire for your children to like never have to go through what you went through, to never experience what like your lowest points were. And, you know, any kid is eventually going to present some dream that more than likely, if karma is real, doesn't fit into your idea of what is going to make a happy life. And that's the look you're talking about. Because you know, you're not stopping them. If you've done a good job as a parent, you're not stopping them. But you want to, you know what I mean? And you know that like, it's, you really have to embrace, like let them do their thing. And I can't, I mean, I'm not, my oldest is 4. Mm-hmm. So what the fuck? I mean, like, you know what I mean? I'm not even close to that moment of like, of payback from the universe for me torturing my mother, because, or my parents, or, and getting off on the torture, getting off on the, you know, like, I'm covered in roaches, mama. I haven't eaten in a week, mama. I got gravy on my tits. I don't know, whatever the fuck happened to you. I fell in a gravy vat, mama. But you know, I think to get back to what the original thing you were talking about is like, you can return exactly back to that thrilling place where you haven't become consumed by the need for affirmation from people or billboards or whatever in any moment. That's sort of the delightful discovery you can make. You can return exactly back to that thrilling place where you haven't become consumed by the need for affirmation from people or billboards or whatever in any moment. That's sort of the delightful discovery you can make. And, you know, especially initially, like when I was trying to meditate, I would think either this feels like Christmas, or I would think this feels like I'm working at summer camp again. And I never quite connected it initially, like why that was the first thing that popped into my head. But it was because back then I just really wasn't thinking about what the fuck I was doing at all. Or at Christmas with the family, you're kind of like, you're okay, you're fine.
There's like a release of responsibility there too. Like the narrative is so heavy, you just feel free in a strange way.
That's it. And then you start, that whatever that is starts extending a little bit, and then you start realizing, oh yeah, right. No, it's not like a summer guy. Because this is where you run into the glory, the people trying to chase the past glory. Because they're making a very, they felt a certain way at some point. That way that they felt, they naturally associate that with what was around them. So they're like, oh, that was when I was like making the touchdown that won the fucking thing. So they're like, that was, but really what they was happening when they made the touchdown, did the pole vault, whatever it was they were experiencing unit of consciousness. And like when you're talking about the moment you are on stage and you are no longer recognizing the audience as you, the audience is part of you or whatever it is, then yeah, now you've cut yourself in half. Mm-hmm. And you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And I think that's what he was aware of is like the moment you break yourself into pieces, even though it's all your own mind, your capacities are diminished exponentially by that. But the moment you try to fake merge with the audience or fake be in the moment, it's even worse. Because now what's worse than someone acting like they're in the moment? It's just, you know what I mean? Audiences can sniff that shit out right away. They know you're full of shit. You're not tricking anybody.
Yeah.
But then when you stumble upon someone like your friend, there, who that just seems to be like what they were somehow they like, you might think they've broken themselves. You know what I mean? You might not, they might seem like wild in a bad way, or you just don't get it. Like, what the fuck is that? Why are they, I don't understand. That looks like a person.
Well,
but that doesn't seem like a person.
There are dudes that I'm in bands with now that aren't really like entertainers, and we battle a little bit of like, you know, anxiety at times together, where we're like, oh, this tour is coming up, and it just feels like, you know, what if the van goes careening off the side of the mountain? There's just a lot of things to worry about. And when you're coming from a less entertainerist standpoint, your obsession is with the piece of art. If you're just really an artist, you know, back behind the curtain,
yeah,
then you're kind of like, all you want to do is lift this piece of work out of your life and put it on a mantle and move on, right? And the way that our sort of mini culture has always done that in music is that you put out the record and then you tour, you know? And that's like a really yes. stiff kind of structure that has been eroding for a while now. I've been at the vanguard of eroding it. I'm the guy that keeps trying to bring music back to my bedroom. You know, I've always been doing that. Like, it started there, and I'm taking it back to the bedroom. I'm not necessarily an entertainer, but I'll get up there if I have to, you know? And so the obsession with the artist is, like, just getting, lifting that piece of work up and then sort of ceasing to have to work on it and then going to the next thing. So being out in front of the audience isn't necessarily... It's just not necessarily my dream. It's not necessarily what makes me happy. It's probably a part of like functioning in the world as a healthy person. Like I think you probably look at it that way too. Like when Aaron says, go out there, go fucking do a show.
Yeah.
And
there's a difference. Sorry to cut you off. There is a difference. So maybe there isn't, I don't know, but it seems like when you're seeing a musician perform a song that's already on an album, mm. the song is baked.
Right, right, right.
Like, people want to hear the song that was on the album. They might get frustrated if there's a deviation
yeah, totally right.
from what you did. Whereas with stand-up, the medium is the audience. Like, you're developing jokes in the moment. You're learning all these, you know, you're learning all these things. You cannot mm-hmm. develop a successful stand-up act in, sadly, you can't, in the fucking... bedroom, or comedians would never go on. No, I don't know how many would go on stage.
Right, right.
They'd all be in their bedrooms working on their jokes, using whatever feedback machine they had to like help dial it in and inducing the necessary levels of terror and fear of bombing to like amplify their passion. So that's a big split, man, which is why I could see as a musician why it would be so. Why going on stage to perform these things would have an element in it that is like different mm-hmm. from a comedian, you know, because unless you're like the Grateful Dead or a jam band or something and people are prepared for you to do a 19 minute like groovy guitar riff in between lyrics of a 3 minute song, you know what I mean?
Well, but even that is like a really familiar like brand texture, right? That's a totally interesting difference between comedy and music. That's it feels like music is a lot more like drudgery sometimes because you're sort of like you always say, like, God, you gotta lift all that stuff up those stairs every fucking yeah. night and all that stuff, and you kind of yeah. like you kind of waltz in and the mic's set up, you know what I mean? It's like,
yeah, man,
totally different.
You're watching Forensic Files for as long as you fucking can. You know the exact amount of time it takes to get from your hotel to the comedy club. You know what I mean? You've spent some time like going over your act, what you're going to say. You're thinking about it, but it's like I'm not having to go in there and like do a sound check 4 hours before showtime.
Yeah, yeah.
Then sit in the green room and then like whatever fucked up thing happens because one of the guitars fucked up or the sound guy at the club is like, rat got in the board or whatever the fuck. Then you have to fix and you have to get I can't even imagine the various panic moments as a performer you have to have when you realize whatever the venue is doesn't have the thing that you desperately need or the cord. I don't know.
Yeah, yeah.
That's a lot to deal with cognitively before you go and do a show.
Well, and
on top of
to return to the impetus of this point is that like, what if you could just stay home? Yeah. What if you didn't have to just do all of that? I'm not like giving like a negative proclamation on it all. I think that playing music for people or in front of people is a totally different part of my life. I mean, that I'd never think about. I just don't, it's not that important to me. But when you see Michael Jordan's like muscles flexing and he's doing that free throw dunk and he's flying through the air, that, I mean, let's take away all the capitalist, you know, connotations of everything going on, all the money being made and all that stuff. Because as a child, when you saw it, it was just a pure moment. It was just a man fucking flying through the air, doing something nobody had ever seen before. You see his muscles flexing and he's about as confident and graceful as a human being can possibly look. He's so yeah. fucking handsome. And he's so aware of himself and what he's doing, you know, for the industry and for the sport. And when he's sort of like, it's literally flexing, you know, the way kids say now, like you're flexing. He's like flexing it. Yeah. And I guess playing live can be more like that, you know, like look at what I can do, you know, look at how good I've become at this thing. But I don't live my life like even, you know, like all my athleticism is just an instinct. It's just a natural thing. It's not something I work on. I don't practice. I don't do any of that stuff. The practice I do is sitting at the computer trying to break the rules. You know what I mean? I'm trying to hear something I literally have never heard. That's my job. You know, I want to hear something that changes my mind, because when you heard the Beatles at 8, 9, that's what happened. You were like a whole fucking doorway, like a Narnia doorway opened, and you stepped into a universe and you were like, whoa, this, it's like black and white to color, you know, like this universe is so varied. Like the ideas are so fantastic, very Willy Wonka, like, but they can be my ideas. I can think, I can create the world just like God did.
Yeah.
I can be part of that dialogue. And that's the drug that pulls me back, not dunking in front of a 9-year-old.
Well, I think that like that is where you will have that. If you're lucky enough and that is what you're in it for, then I think that's a like pretty much the best thing, because you really like that. To me, that is the like that nothing can replace that feeling of sitting in the laboratory and fucking around, or whatever you want to call it, your alchemical chamber, your ritual summoning cube that you try to summon spirits into, whatever it is. When you feel that and the going into it, and when you go into it with no sense of like anything maybe, or it's just some like non-linguistic like a grunting kind of feeling, you don't even know what it fuck it is, and a lot of the times it's nothing. It's like, you know, watching Aaron go through her third pregnancy and watching the parallels in pregnancy to so many other things, the like they swell up, it's uncomfortable. False alarms. Am I even pregnant? What's going on? I haven't felt the baby in a little bit. Like all of these things, it's a perfect analogy for like trying to create anything. Like it's the exact same pattern. Like so you get like, you're up sometimes because you know the baby's healthy and everything's going right. You're down sometimes because whatever the pattern that you were used to experiencing with the baby has changed. You, prior to the birth, you get false alarms. A lot of stuff will come out of you that is definitely not a baby. And that can be scary and frustrating. It's so similar. You know, I mean, God, what is worse than I don't even know if you get this. But in my experience, in my own way of making my podcast intros or trying to write, the blue balls. You know what I mean? The blue balls that you get. When you come in there and you already know you're fucked, You're all blurry. You're just not there, man. And then you leave after wrestling with whatever it was you were trying to get out. You already know it's bad, but I don't know if you do this. I'll trick myself into thinking that's good. And then you come back because you come back with those new ears after time has passed. You know what I'm talking about?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And you're like, I'm going to listen to this or read this, and it's going to either make me feel like I have some forward momentum, or I will feel like I have gone insane, or I will just be like, look, what the fuck? I'm doomed. Do you know what I'm talking about?
Yeah.
This is the pattern, the process. And I think there are some people that is, and then add to that time collapse. When it mounts you and then you're not even there anymore anyway, time vanishes, hours have passed, you're missing phone calls, you don't give a shit who's calling you, you don't give a shit what's happening, you don't care, the alarms are going off, the dogs are barking, whatever it is, you're not even hearing it. And I think that might sound exciting from the outside, but that can be really quite uncomfortable to be gone for a little bit while you're making something. And I think all of these components are not, for a lot of people, they don't want that at all. They don't want that. That doesn't sound good at all. That doesn't sound good to not exist for a few hours and to come out of the non-existence with something that isn't that great.
I think if you, well, the secret basically to everything is that, And the sad thing about this is probably just an instinctual temperament, but like, if you're traveling through a labyrinth, which is making one piece of art, or a labyrinth, which is your whole life, it's always better to just err on the side of positivity. Because each time a door is closed and you have to figure out a way to open it, you're just not gonna open it. If you err on the side of negativity, like there's just the only way through is positivity. So like, no matter what happens, if it's the most debilitating, inane, like costly, you know, error, you still have to go forward. You can't go back. I think that's the secret. And I think that in a way, that goes back to the great moment of John Casey, our professor, for our existentialist Taoist professor, the moment where I wrote this whole thesis. We had to do like the year long, like the thesis was whatever you want it to be. We've talked about this before, I think, and kids were doing like legalized marijuana. And I was in a very bad state, and my thesis was on how suicide is a relative option. It's a great option if you want it. And I got in front of the I got in front of the class, and I was in a really bad mental state, and I was pacing, and everyone gave me, they had like a little suggestion box thing, like where everybody gave a review, and I just completely got an F across the board because people didn't understand what I was, where it was coming from.
They're putting suicide hotline numbers in the suggestion box.
Well, actually what they said was, I've said this before on probably a podcast we did, but they every little piece of paper said, he's drunk. Why is he drunk? Or he's on drugs or something. But that was how, like, that was my vibe. I just gave off this vibe that I was, but it was because I was in a really unsafe state of mind that made them really uncomfortable. So they're like, oh, he's on drugs. But I was completely just in a terror zone. And even the teacher gave me a deer and F. And he was just like, what the fuck were you thinking? And I went into his office and I was like, how dare you not trust me, dude? You know, like, we're really close, bro. Like, what were you thinking? This is what I'm going through. And all I did was report it to you. And once he got my sincerity, he was like, it went to an A, but he was like, oh, you're that fucked up. He felt the gravity of it. I don't think it was a pity. But he was just kind of like, oh, you meant what you said. And I was like, that's the difference. I actually mean it. And
that's
so
cool.
That his big response to my thesis on suicide was, well, at least as far as I remember, he was like, if life doesn't matter, if slitting your wrist is just a motion, just like taking a step or pouring some coffee, then you're totally free. And if you're totally free, why not just invent whatever you want? And why not do whatever you want?
Yeah.
And in that moment, I was like, God, he is logically, he's just so correct that you can't refute that, you know? Like,
right.
He would always show open the door for me. And like that's an example of positivity trumping negativity, right? And so he just lay it out there for you. And like you just had no choice but to absorb the actual truth. So that's where I got that idea, I think. But also it's our temperament. You know, we found the problem solving part of ourselves, and we let that push us forward, you know.
Yeah, man. I mean, this is the, like, if the mind is not trained, it is like a wild elephant. And, you know, a untrained mind will habitually veer towards negativity, I think, just as a, maybe an evolutionary safety mechanism. Maybe it's safer to be negative. Maybe because if you're more negative, you're going to protect yourself more or something like that. Whereas, like, if you've sort of come to this realization of the meaninglessness or a kind of like neutral thing, then your answer is suicide or something like that, the mistake would be thinking that it's like you already have committed suicide. You're bad news. Like there's nothing to, what are you going to annihilate anyway? Like what's the so then there's a decision, a training that has to start happening where, yeah, you're in positivity. I think the word gets used so much now. People think it associated with a fake smile or something,
right.
You know, versus a, like, you know, it's like when your wife is fucking pregnant and you're trying to comfort them as a dude who is not blasting out chunks of stuff from their pussy and wondering if the thing inside of them is like alive or could die.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? And you're getting the closer you get to the baby coming, you get these practice contractions. And you're so excited because you think this could be it. This is it. I'm about to go into labor. The baby is coming. But no, they start going away and the morning comes and you're just filled up with a baby and you got to go through another day. And it's like, yeah, all I could say was like, it's a step forward. Every time you get those, it's getting closer. We're getting closer. A step forward. For better or for worse. You know, maybe there isn't really much you could say. But yeah, to me, that was the most positive spin on the damn thing. It's like, you know, having some sense of like, no, this is still good. It's still good. It's still good. No matter what. No matter what. You just get to decide that anyway. It's still good. That's the, with all of it, with every single little piece of it. Yeah. It's like, I feel like there's a way to do that that's real and not faith-based too.
Mm-hmm.
Like there's a way to do that by like tuning into a more fundamental reality to things, you know, that is really quite boring and dull for most people, you know, like I used to get so freaked out before I went on stage, man. And like, think that was a good sign that I was freaked out. I would think, oh, this is good. Like it means you care. But and then I would think if I'm not freaked out, it won't be a good show. And then I can remember because I'm doing this meditation shit and I can remember like one day in the hotel room before I was going to perform for about 3 seconds, I didn't feel scared. And I was like, what is this? What is this? That's crazy. Like nothing. I didn't feel like the thing, you know? And that is a possible way to exist, I think, where it's like every single day could be that. Like not just 3 seconds, every single day could be that of like, this is fine. no matter what's going on, no matter the pressure of having to like do a show or give birth or whatever it may be. And this is theoretical, I would say, but for me, that's sort of theoretical, but that's, you know, there's some people, I was telling my friend, there's some people, they go to the airport, they're not stressed out. I don't know what you're like when you go to the airport, but I go to the fucking airport, my butthole's so tight. I'm so fucking anxiety ridden. I fucking hate every single step of the way. I don't want to go through TSA. There's some people, they drive to the airport, they're fine. Not fake fine. They drive to the airport, they walk right through, their blood pressure doesn't go up. Nothing is bothering them.
Well, that, like, that energy is just like compartmentalized in a different part of their life. You know, they have road rage, or they have some other compartment where they experience that tension, but it does seem like a nice sort of thing to go out on, I guess, is that negativity is sort of predictable and sort of like a way to not open the door, whereas opening the door with a sort of positive step forward is a gateway to the unknown, which is good or bad depending on your interpretation, right?
Yeah, man. I mean, this is the... Somebody was telling me it's always better to act.
Right.
You know, it's always better to act. It's always better to make a decision, is what they said. It's always better to make the decision. Open the door. Make the decision. It's always better than not. Always. 100% of the time, always better. Even if the door opens up to feral weasels or whatever the fuck it is, it's still like... That getting in the practice of just pushing through all those because the weasels aren't real. It is better always. I like it. You know, I've identified a feeling whenever I run into one of those doors you're talking about. First, you have to recognize the door, right? That's the first step. Some people don't even understand that's a door. That's not a fucking a wall covered in spikes.
Right, right.
That's a door. And that feeling that I always get is like, I can't do this. This isn't my thing. This is out of my realm. I don't do that. I can't. What is this? And then the moment you like go towards that instead of running away from it, God damn, I'm sorry to keep using these birth analogies, man, but like, Jesus fucking Christ, A, so glad I can't make babies. It is crazy to watch. Dude, it is crazy. And there's a lot of great jokes. I would refer you to Whoopi Goldberg's joke on pregnancy. But like when you hear a midwife tell your wife, I know you feel like you're being split in half right now. And I know that it seems so paradoxical, but the next time you feel the peak of that, push into it. Go towards it with all your might. Push into that, because that is how the baby will come. And like, this is a person talking calmly to someone who is screaming the way you would scream if you were being ripped apart by lions. You know what I mean? Like that to me is the instruction for everything. That's the instruction.
Yeah, yeah.
It doesn't make sense. I don't want to go there. Fuck that. I can't. I'm exhausted. There's no way. But it's like, oh, you have to, because you have a fucking baby stuck in you right now. And if that thing doesn't come out, everybody's in trouble. Everybody's in trouble. It is wild, dude. Wild. And that, I think that is, I don't know. Thank God we will never experience whatever that feels like. Thank God we made the right decision in the Garden of Eden. Thank God we did not eat of the forbidden fruit. We're punished by God in birth. But fuck, dude. Like that, to me, if you start habituating yourself towards not running away from the worst moments, running into them, jumping down those stairs, you know, whatever it is. Fuck skateboarding. I can't believe you could do that, dude. I was always so jealous of skateboarders.
Well, I mean, what you're saying too is that like giving into it going forward probably isn't going to make it that much easier the next time either, right?
No.
It's not
there.
It's
I mean,
not
it just
be easier.
How can it be easy? If it was easy, everyone would do it. That's the problem, right? If it was easy, everyone's breaking the record. Everyone's writing the book. There would be no book packers. There would just be mountains of these incredible fucking books all over the unpackaged, beautiful books written by everybody. You know, it's impossible. It's almost impossible. And it's impossible on every level. But number one, it's never going to happen if you don't force yourself into the frying pan. And you can't expect that eventually it's going to get better forcing yourself into the frying pan just because you did it before. It always sucks. I mean, I guess the difference is you get some familiarity with the zone versus like thinking this is a malfunction of my life. I don't know.
Yeah. You're like, did I feel this bad last time? Probably. I think so.
Can I tell you a quick story about skateboarding?
Let's do this.
I know we got to go. It's been a while, and I do have a new baby that needs to be a mommy. He's got to get some food probably. But so my kids, I'm trying to teach them about practice. You know, if you practice, you'll get better at things. And you give them these very cliche, you know, to learn how to do anything, you're going to fall down. That's just part of what it is. And you got to get back up and try again. So we're out in the driveway. I've literally just given them this like cereal box inspirational speech because they're trying to learn how to ride scooters. And so I pull a skateboard out of the shed. And I'm like, you know, I always wanted to learn how to ollie and I never really could do it, but I'm going to try now. I don't know what I thought would happen.
Bad idea.
This is like a shitty skateboard, by the way. And I'm not blaming it on the skateboard. I just could never know. Like, this is a skateboard that's been out in the rain, under the sprinklers. You know what I mean? The trucks are just loose as fuck. But I take that stupid skateboard. I got it at Target. I take that skateboard, put it on the sidewalk. You can guess what happens. Try to do an ollie. Immediately just wipe out. Bam! Daddy's on the fucking... on the sidewalk. I've landed on my hip. You know, I'm like, did I break my hip? Dude, I forgot the pain of falling on concrete. Like, I hadn't felt that pain in so long. I don't know. It's been at least 2 decades since I'd like crashed into concrete with my body. And they are laughing so hard. And then because I'm giving this shitty lecture, I have to try it again. I can't be like, you got to get up, dust yourself off and try again, kids. Oh, no. And I can't blame it on the skateboard. You know what I mean? So I had to like get back up on the skateboard and like I performatively tried it a few more times, almost falling both of those times, and then like put the skateboard back in the shed. But you know what I mean? It's like, talk about like put your money where the fucking mouth is, where your mouth is. Because it sure is easy to say run into the fire. But when you are the one who has to run into the fire and not advise it, you know what I mean? That's a whole different world.
Well, that whole leaning into nihilism thing that we were doing on a hardcore tip, we were sort of maybe doing that because there was just no other choice. There was no other reference point. But I think that after you've sort of acknowledged the protective attitude can be good sometimes, like later in life, you sort of like, you look at the 18 stairs and you're like, no, like not today. That kind of, you get a little used to like, you know, trying to protect yourself a little bit. So returning quickly to that level of nihilistic decision-making it's shocking. I mean, there's nothing in the world like skateboarding exactly. I mean, maybe like free climbing on Everest or something. I mean, it's the most deadly, constantly deadly thing you can put yourself, you know, at that level of risk all the time. And so you think about just their bodies, just like the level of being like the worst bruise you've ever had in your life is just the daily, like you wake up and your ankles turn and your hip is deeply bruised and there's blood
you're
all over
limping.
You. Yeah. I mean, that's just their sort of daily warrior like reality. And I can take away that attitude and apply it to music much more safely. And and thank God I'm not going to like bloody myself on the keyboard, but like, I still would take from hardcore and that stuff. And like that level of like risk taking is super important. I just don't want to endanger, you know, my ability to keep doing it. That's all.
Yeah, dude, we got these old ass bodies. Now, you're not supposed to say that, apparently. It's called geezering is the name for it, where you assign age to yourself. I mean, the truth is, we're pain adverse, man. It's like, and I'll tell you, that fucking concrete hurts so bad. And my knee, I was limping for days. But God damn it, there was something nice about that limp. Like, you know what I mean? There was something in that limp that I'm like, fuck, man. I wiped the fuck out on my own driveway. I fucking smashed into asphalt. I'm almost 50 and I'm okay. I'm walking around. I'm not going to fucking try to ollie again necessarily, but I felt the call. It's not just like, you're like, I don't want to do that. You're like, kind of like, God damn, I want to try that again. I want to try that again. All you need is one little, like, maybe I'll try it one more time. And then one more time. And then, dude, come on. The moment where you're doing it, you know what I mean? Where the falls have decreased and the success rates have gone up and you're reminded of your own power and that you have confronted something and prevailed. It doesn't matter. Yeah, are you Shackleton? Did you like somehow manage to like get all of, like get lost in the ice and find your way back and none of your men died? No, you're not Shackleton. But it's a tiny, infinitesimally small, fractional part of what that feels like. Are you Kobe Bryant? Are you Michael Jordan? No. But you're a spark of that. Yeah, you're feeling that. You're on the planet. That day, you were one small part of a rebellion, a revolution, not against some government, but against gravity, against common sense, and against safety in a world where it's just everyone wants you to be fucking safe. It's the religion. If aliens, there are probably many aliens are like, they worship safety. There's some religion of safety there. They have their altars of safety. They have signs that have upon them. Yeah, that's what they would think. So for one second, you've blasphemed against that aspect of culture, and it's a glorious feeling.
Well, there's got to be some, you know, the nature of God's mind is the same. Like, the nature of God's tendencies is the same. The nature of creating the world, there's going to be a lot of furious working. There's going to be a lot of taking it for granted. There's going to be moments of realizing that creativity is the highest level of existence. There's going to be, there's going to be a spectrum of emotions. There's not going to be just constant triumph, right? So I think that it's normal to take doing the 360 kickflip off the 18 stairs for granted sometimes, but you hope you don't do it for very long because the fact that you're so embattled and that you've gotten through all these mornings with the deep bruises and you've gotten to that point, it's the fact that you kept going through the doors, the fact that you kept trying that put you on this plateau of complexity in terms of your articulation, your talent, you know? So I think that is in itself one of the biggest tasks is like appreciation, you know?
My friend, this is why I have a massive butt plug in right now. I do it I never wanted to admit it, but with every podcast, it gets a little bigger. And every time I'm like, I don't think I can do this one. And every time I realize I can.
Oh man, a guy I'm in a band with actually tells this great story about how he decided to let someone peg him. And
yeah,
I mean, I don't know any other pegging stories, within my personal circle. So this was pretty eventful.
I'm sorry. I know we talked about no self-promotion, guys. Coming out next month, pegging stories. That's actually weirdly, I guess we are synced up. That's my new book coming out, and it's all the times I've been pegged, and it's a 700-page book.
It's an
it's actually two volumes.
It's an exploding market right now. But so, so his story, I mean, he tells it with such a nonchalance, but he's like, it really didn't go so well. I went down to buy myself the dildo.
Hmm.
And you're like, yeah, okay, this is that's like probably the best case scenario. And he gets to the afternoon delight party or whatever you want to call it, and he's like, and it was much too big for me. And I just, you know, that's the point of the story where I always stop and I'm like, but how did you misjudge that? You know, you had full control over the anyway. It's a wonderful Van tail.
You know, this is why when you're picking out your peg, your first pegging dildo, don't do it based on the beauty of the dick. You know, do it on size, because a lot of these dildos that you see, you know, you might be like, that's a beautiful cock, I would love to have that rammed into my asshole.
Yeah,
but you do that, then you're gonna get this what he experienced. You know, just like, don't go on aesthetics at first. And that's not just with dildos, that's with cocks.
Pegging Stories out next month.
Pegging Stories out next month. If you pre-order it, you will have access to my OnlyFans. And it's some good stuff, guys. The skateboarding show scene I just did is, wow, hot. Emil, tell me again. I know you do not self-promote. If you ask me, you could do it some more self-promotion because your shit is my favorite music. Don't mean to like make you uncomfortable. I know this does. But I've started like listening to your music on Spotify, going through it. It's so beautiful. It is so powerful. And I'm excited to hear that you have a new album coming out. So where can we find that?
Yeah, with respect to the label Drag City, I should tell people to go to their website and check out Zone Black. It's basically music based on the like eerie, dismal, awkward stuff that, you know, the Lonely Man theme at the end of The Hulk in 1977 or something.
Oh, wow.
It's based on that kind of like awkward, scarred feeling you get when you think back to Risky Business and the train ride and just like that, you know, you were too young to experience that. So I'm trying to recreate that uncomfortable feeling.
Jesus Christ, that's crazy and beautiful.
I'll send you one right now.
Thank you, friend.
Yeah.
Emil, I love you. Thank you so much for coming on the show, and I hope I get to see you soon.
Yeah, let's do it again soon.
That was Emil Amos, everybody. Don't forget to check out his new album on Drag City, Zone Black, or any of his other projects. Thank you all for listening. If you want commercial-free episodes of this podcast, you can always subscribe to us at patreon.com/DTFH. I'll see you in a few days when I'm a little less bleary. Blurry? Is that the word? I don't even know how to say it. I'm tired. I'll see you soon. Bye.